Hi, I'm Femi OK. Today on The Stream, we are bringing you three stories in one show. A key vote in southern Ethiopia, Venezuela's new currency, and long-running tensions in Tunisia. There is so much to cover, but I will always make time to include your comments and questions. You can join the conversation live right now on YouTube. We start with Ethiopia, where election officials are verifying the outcome of a referendum that could lead to the country's 11th state. People in six parts of the southern nation's nationalities and people's region were asked if they want a new southwest state. Have a listen to what some voters were thinking just ahead of the referendum.
Everyone, from children to adults, wants Kaffa to become a region. This place, as you can see, is a very dense forest, and we have a lot of coffee.
In the rest of the country, everything is growing and changing. When I compare Kaffa with other places, it's still backwards.
For more on this, we are joined by Bereket Eshetu Mesele. He is a lawyer and lecturer who writes about political trends in southern Ethiopia. Bereket, so good to have you. I'm going to start with a map. The SNPPR region in Ethiopia, the red area there. If you were going to give us a little introduction to this area, what would you tell us about the geography, the people, the ethnic groups all mixed up in this area? Tell us. Introduce us.
Thank you very much for having me. In fact, this the SNNPR is one of the huge region in the country. It has more than 56 nations nationalities within it. It do have huge natural resources and also human capacity. But from the inception of the federal system in the country, there are turmoils over political turmoils for the question having an independent state by different region, and basically the main factors that leads for us for having an independent region was there are various factors, but one of the major reason was just related with failure to find an administrative structure that works for the multiple groups within this region. Mm-hmm. And as a result, this has led for various ethnic groups in this region to quest for having an independent region. And that one of the southwest region, which has casted a vote for a referendum, is one of the indication of that.
I'm just looking here at people voting in the referendum. Have a look here on my laptop, Bereket. How did the referendum go? We don't know the results yet, but how did it go? Was it uneventful?
Basically, yeah, there is a strong expectation that at the end there is a probability that the region will be founded, the new region. And this was very strongly asked by the peoples within the region, and I hope that the referendum will end up with.
All right. So, if there is a new southwest regional state, what difference will that make?
Exactly, it makes a huge difference. For instance, one of the difficulty related with the existing structure is that although federalism is sought to give local people the opportunity to administer themselves, due to the great geographical distance between this region and the center, that is the seat of the regional state, that's Hawassa, the people were not able to make their voice be heard, for rules to understand their needs, aspiration, the priority. Even the state officials were not able to supervise whether their policies has been implemented at local level. For instance, it takes more than 3 days to go to the regional seat, Hawassa, from the most peripheral areas of Shekha and Bench Zone. So if this state, if the current structure is in its place, it hugely solved the problem of efficient administration of the region. And also, if you look at the other reason, there is a strong problem that in this region, in the South Nation Nationalities and People region in general, all ethnic groups were lumped together, and it does not adequately manage the settlement pattern, the language, and other factors as stated under the constitution. But if you look at the Southwest region, which is going to be established, it tries to integrate that into account. For instance, those zones which were within the Southwest region, the new region, do have some communal settlement pattern, and the peoples do have some very similar language they speak. And so many advantages are there.
All right, Berekay, I want to put this to you. This is from Goitom. He is a political analyst, although I feel that every Ethiopian is a political analyst. So I want to bring this comment in because he is predicting what the central government and how the central government will react to this referendum. Have a listen and then react immediately off the back of this video.
Regardless of the outcome of the referendum, people in southern Ethiopia can at best hope for cultural autonomy and that they cannot expect political self-determination. The central government will, as it is doing elsewhere in the country, assign individuals that are loyal to them and repress those that are opposed to them in the regional government.
Yeah, exactly. It's rightly stated, because even the establishment of this region, before the establishment of this region, I do have a lot of information that the government, the central government, was trying to organize the committee which will probably organize the new state, how the way it could be established, and other officials which will handle responsibly the organization of the new state. And I think the problem of the central government was in the time for making the referendum, because there is a general election which was expected by central government before. That time has already passed, and the central government has established its own, the national election is already passed. Now,
Berekay, thank you so much. Just as your connection is about to peter out, it's a perfect timing, because I just have enough time to say thank you so much for bringing us your thoughts about the potential of a new Southwest state in Ethiopia. Next, we head to Venezuela, where people are getting used to a new currency. The government is trying to fight runaway inflation and says that banking will be easier under the new Bolivar. It's the third time that the currency has been reset since 2008. Here's what some locals in Caracas are saying.
The first time, 3 zeros were removed from the currency. The second time, it was 5 zeros. And now, another 6 zeros have been removed from the currency. Then they say that this does not affect the value of products. How can it not? If you add the whole bunch of zeros to today's bolivar, what does that represent? Here, there is even inflation on the dollar. But that's the way it is. We have no choice but to live one day at a time.
For me, I believe that the only thing that is going to improve is that I won't be carrying so much money. Because to carry $5 worth of bolivars in cash, you have to carry it in a suitcase. So, I believe that the only thing that would benefit us would not be carrying so much cash in our pockets. Nothing else, because the prices do not go down. They keep going up.
Sarah Kenosian is a correspondent covering Latin America for Reuters. Hello, Sarah. I'm wondering if that gentleman was exaggerating. Would you really need a suitcase previously to carry around $5 worth of the previous Venezuelan currency? Was that over the top?
No, he's right. And he's a bus driver. So they're the very small portion of the population that actually ever handled bolivares. Yeah. When I was... You know, I was there for over 2 years, and I never once used bolivares in cash. So, you know, I think what this currency change does is essentially just make transactions easier.
I'm just trying to imagine what happened. What's the difference if you're living in Venezuela the day before the currency was introduced and then the days after? How would I know if I'm going about my life, going about my work? What's different now?
It's funny because actually I had a friend text me and say, so I have $30 worth of bolivares in my bank account. People don't keep very much cash in their bank account because of inflation. So you lose a lot of money, which has not changed with this currency change. Saying, it was meant to go to the grocery store. Can I still use it to go to the grocery store? And really what the answer was yes. It just slashed off another six zeros. So what, you know, let's say this changes all the time, but if $1 was worth 4 million bolivares before, it's now worth four bolivares.
All right.
So when you go in to look at the prices, instead of, you know, a dollar of whatever peaches equaling 4 million, it would just be four. And then that way, that obviously, like, the highest bill note before was a $1 million bolivare, and now it's a one bolivar coin. So that reduces the amount of cash people need to hold on them.
All right. So what about salaries? Let's take a teacher's salary, for instance. How are they faring up right now in terms of this new currency, trying to course correct the economy? What would a teacher's salary be like today?
Well, I mean, that's a little bit difficult because Venezuela is in this process of, over the past 2 years, the dollar has been used a lot and it has just grown in popularity, and now it's basically used for everything. So Venezuela is kind of trying to figure out how to adapt to this because some people, it's a very small section of the population, do earn in dollars or foreign currency. But for instance, state workers still make a minimum wage, which hovers around $3 a month. So, you know, this currency doesn't change basically anything other than change doesn't it doesn't change anything other than calculations.
Sure.
And accounting.
Sarah, so I want to show you this on my laptop. It's from a tweet because they knew we were talking about Venezuela today. So ABM263 says the measures illustrate the fact that USA needs to lift the financial sanctions it imposes on nations to impact Venezuela's politics because only the regular citizens on the ground suffer. Thoughts, Sarah?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say, first of all, the economic recession in Venezuela started around 2014. And the first, actually, the first time that they did this to the currency happened in 2008. The recession started in 2014, and then the U.S. imposed the first round of sanctions in 2017. And then the economy got really bad. I think that, and then they did it again in 2019 against a state oil company. And you definitely, it has made conditions, the sanctions have made conditions on the ground worse. But conditions were taking a very downward trend beforehand. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a question about inflation and curbing inflation. So Venezuelans can feel like they have a place to store their money.
Right.
And basically right now, right, the inflation is just going to continue. So for instance, none of my friends hold money in bolivares in their bank accounts. It's just on a transactional basis. So you need to pay, I don't know, a painter, or you need to pay somebody in bolivares, then you have to go and find someone to sell you the bolivares to keep it in their bank account.
Right.
And, you know, access to U.S. dollars is very hard because of the sanctions. So just to give you an idea, you know, by the end of my time in Venezuela, which was 4 days ago, you know, people were walking back into the country with thousands of dollars in cash on them, wow, often to even resell it because there'd be shortages of $1 bills.
Right. Let me play this to you. This is Guillermo. He spoke to us just a few hours ago. Sarah, have a listen, then respond immediately. Okay. Off the back of the video. Here's Guillermo.
The problem here is a loss of confidence. 4 years of hyperinflation have pushed most Venezuelans to abandon their currency. In fact, roughly two-thirds of retail transactions are being done in U.S. dollars. Venezuela's problems run much deeper than just zeros on a bill. The latest measure won't do much to revert the 70% GDP decline since 2013 and won't bring back the 5 million people who have left the country since.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the feeling on the ground. from the people, my friends, people who I know there, it wasn't really of much importance to them. Of course, it'll make it easier because, you know, you don't have to print like 27 million on a receipt and you don't need to swipe a credit card multiple times to be able to just pay for like a box of strawberries or whatever. But he's right. At the end of the day, inflation is continuing. And although it's slowed with the introduction of the dollar, it still hovers around 2,000%.
So I'm just going to quickly go to your Twitter account. Yeah. This is Sarah Kenosian at Eskenosian, if you want to follow Sarah, which I know you do. A new study showing that 76.6% of Venezuelans live in extreme poverty, up from 67% last year. I mean, we're talking about currency here, but this is the real story, right?
Yeah. And, you know, again, what's weird is that, I mean, now essentially Venezuela is moving towards a dual currency situation. But these dollars and the private industry that you'll see, you know, there's a lot of things happening on Instagram, for instance, and there's a lot less shortage of goods because they relaxed import controls. But that's a very small sliver of the population that can actually access them. So most people, you know, like exactly extreme poverty, they're living on less than, I think, $1.20 a day.
Wow.
And prices have increased with the dollarization and they continue to increase. So while, for instance, you can technically get medicine, you can't, nobody can buy it.
Yeah. Sarah Kenosian from Reuters, thank you so much for joining us on the stream today. Really appreciated your analysis. Finally, to Tunisia, where the gulf between supporters and opponents of Tunisia's president appears to be widening. Rallies both for and against President Kais Saied have taken place in Tunis recently. Here are some voices from both sides of the divide.
We want to deliver a word to Kais Saied, no going back now, and to prosecute all those who have committed crimes against the people. That is the main and first demand, to prosecute all those who have wronged the people.
The most important demands are the return to the constitution and the parliament. There is no country in the world without a parliament and without a constitution. And there is no country in the world in which a person has monopoly on all authorities. And we are against it. Even the ousted dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali did not monopolize all power in the way that Kais Saied did. This is very strange.
For more on the tensions in Tunisia, we are joined by independent journalist Sam Kimball. Sam, good to see you. I'm going to be quite tough on you to start off with. Your headline, what would your headline be that sums up what is happening in Tunisia this week, today? What would you go with?
Despite the appointment of of the country's first female prime minister, major questions remain about Tunisia's democratic transition.
Oh, you're fast. Let's talk about the mood in the country. Give us an example of that mood. How would you sum it up?
Well, I think you could say most places that you go in the country, the feeling that you might get on the street is you might get a sense of anxiety, of tension. I mean, things in many neighborhoods, in a lot of cities, I mean, kind of street life seems to be going on as normal, or as normal has been over the last several years. But there's a lot of anxiety, and a lot of that comes from, or is produced by at least, the tension between those who support the president, Kais Saied's exceptional measures that he took on July 25th, which include freezing of the parliament and the dismissal of the prime minister, along with stripping parliamentary immunity. Supporters of those measures that he's taken on the 25th of July and since, and those who are opposed, you know, and often very staunchly opposed, and those who are kind of waiting it out. And I think those who are waiting it out kind of in a middle ground are those, you know, with the greatest sense of anxiety. I was speaking to, for example, a longtime activist and organizer down in a southwestern city. It's a mining city, brings a lot of the country's wealth, in fact, but long marginalized. And she was saying that she had gone out initially on July 25th to support the president's these extraordinary measures that he took. She thought it was the only way that the squabbling and the major dysfunctionality in the government and the parliament in particular could be stopped was through these measures, and she thought that was the only way. And she initially expressed some kind of hedged optimism about the appointment of Tunisia's first female prime minister. When pushed a little further, though, many of her doubts came out. She said, okay, we have to wait and see if this prime minister will bring any good things to the country. But she ended up saying, but this prime minister has very little authority, especially in face of the president's kind of consolidated executive and legislative authority. And so she said, we simply cannot have a return to the days of the dictatorship, as she said, right, under the former president, Ben Ali. So there's a lot of ambiguity and ambivalence. And then some, if you speak to the kind of more activist-y crowd, folks who follow politics more closely and get involved on the street, those who were out in the revolution of 2011, there's a lot of pessimism, you know, about and a fear about a return of dictatorship, as they've said.
Sam, I want to play you Fadel Kaboub. He's an economics professor at Denison University. Have a listen and then respond.
I'm afraid that the support that the president currently has will gradually dissipate and disappear, and then we'll find ourselves in a deeper political crisis with no constitution, with no parliament, with no coherent economic vision to take the country out of this quagmire.
Yeah, there is an interesting, a worrying position that the country finds itself in now, where the president, Kais Saied, has concentrated so many executive and legislative and justice powers in his own hands since the 25th of July, and removed those from higher institutions that could review his decisions or check these powers, that it leaves opposition with really only kind of more radical options, whether that's taking to the street or striking or otherwise. So there aren't these kind of formal political institutions, the ones that have been constructed since the revolution of 2011, to kind of mediate these conflicts and check his powers. So indeed, I was just speaking to a well-known activist and journalist who lives down the street from me in my neighborhood. She was saying that she thinks that the political as well as the economic situation, which has been central to all of this, will decline further.
So I'm trying to see and try and understand what impact this political turmoil is having on everyday life. How do you see it playing out?
Well, it's been, I feel like what gets a lot of the a lot of media attention and a lot of analysis is the political turmoil at kind of the high level, at the formal level. But what has powered that, or what has powered a lot of the social turmoil as well as political, most recently has been the COVID epidemic.
Oh, good point. Yeah.
Which Tunisia had initially responded to quite well in the first months of 2011. With one of the lowest infection and death rates in all of Africa, but which by the time of the president's mm-hmm. extraordinary measures had become the highest death rate in the world due to COVID. So there was massive outrage, there was massive frustration due to the mishandling of this pandemic and health crisis,
right.
Not to mention the rapidly rising inflation, and unemployment, and because of the COVID crisis, tremendous crisis in loss of jobs for ordinary people, especially in the informal sector.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's caused a lot of confusion on the streets.
Sam, thank you so much. That's Sam Kimball. Have a look here on my laptop. You can follow him on Twitter. I do. Sam on the road. And you can catch up with all the latest on Tunisia via Sam's Twitter feed. Thanks for watching. If you've ever got a story idea for us at The Stream, you can tweet us at AJStream. I'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.